I believe in a physician-assisted suicide. Let me just put that out front, and people can disagree. My first wife died by suicide, and I think that one of the reasons why some people are opposed to physician-assisted suicide is because we have problems with the word suicide. It still has some scandalous overtones. Somebody has called it the last taboo in our society. We are not very understanding of, and in certain circles not very accepting of, people who have found death more attractive than life. Most of us have difficulty understanding a person who is in that situation, because most of us cannot imagine being in that situation ourselves. I understand very well a person being in that situation. My wife was ill for 4.5 years, treated by psychiatrists. She made a suicide attempt, made two attempts over a period of those 4.5 years. And then one day found a way that worked. My 11-year-old boy came home from winning a soccer game all excited and found his mother's body hanging from a rafter in the living room of our house. I have had to move from anger toward Helen for doing that to accepting her doing that, but accepting it still has a little nuance of negativism. I've had to move from anger to acceptance to honoring her decision. Now that may startle some of you, that I honor her decision. She found a way of dealing with her plight. You see, she had multiple sclerosis, and she was gradually more and more and more deteriorating. She could not see any hope at the end of the tunnel. I have worked with suicide families now for many years. My wife died in 1975. I've developed some suicide grief support groups in the Twin Cities and elsewhere in that part of the world. And I've sat with one of those groups for 10 years as a facilitator, twice a month. I've met literally hundreds of suicide survivors. By suicide survivor, I do not mean someone who attempted and survived. I mean someone who's left behind after completed suicide. And there isn't any circumstance that I haven't heard of. And it seems to me that we must come at some point in time when we are far more accepting of suicide. I'm going to put it crassly, as simply one of the ways by which people die. And I don't want to sound too bizarre when I say that, but I mean that precisely. A youthful suicide is a tragedy of the first order. But there are people who have reached the end of their lives, and we have the magnificent capability in our culture to keep people alive long after they want to be alive. And the cost financially and the emotionally and the pain to family and friends is simply enormous. I find it very, very sad that Helen had to lock the doors of our house. She had to figure out, though she could hardly stand on her feet, figure out how to get a dog chain up over that rafter, get up on a chair, and risk the possibility of failing in her death. I find that enormously sad. Why wasn't there somebody who could have helped her to find what she needed at that point in time? That's all I'll say now. Maybe that's enough to set up the issue.
Introduce yourself and make your presentation.
I'm Al Hansen. When Everly asked me this morning if I would sit in on this, I said I really don't have any qualifications for it, except for the fact that for a few years I served as the administrator of a nursing home, where I saw lots of lots of people who suffered over long, long periods of time. He also said that there would be several other people here, which I don't see, so I guess we have to work. So I went in this afternoon, I went into the research library in here to see if I could pick up any kind of information regarding physician-assisted suicide. And I found this paper, Chapter 22, Physician-Assisted Suicide, out of a book, Aging and God, by H.G. Kroeger, a medical doctor. And I find that there's lots and lots of information regarding physician, what we call PAS. If I use it, that's the easiest way to say it. And what is, and he starts out by saying, what is a physician-assisted suicide? What is PAS? Well, let me just read a little bit what he has says. First of all, let us examine what PAS is not. It is not pulling plugs to ventilators, removing feeding tubes or intravenous lines, failing to institute life-saving treatments, such as antibiotics, medication, surgery, and so forth, limiting food or water or any other action or non-action which allows nature to take her course. All of these are what to call passive euthanasia. PAS involves the person taking their own life with the active assistance of a physician. Which we're all acquainted with what Dr. Kevorkian the way in which he assists people in taking their own lives. He sets it up, and then they actually do the action that takes their life. That's kind of what he says as far as what it is. The systems can take two general forms, though, which are distinct but closely related. The physician may provide the suicidal person with the means to commit the act, or the physician may carry out the patient's wish to die by injecting or otherwise administering lethal medications. Two different ways. All doctors, you know, are asked to and must actually take the Hippocratic Oath, which says, I will never give a deadly drug to anyone if asked for it, nor will I make a suggestion to this effect. So, see, one of the dilemmas which we face is in the medical profession, the policies of the AMA and the Geriatric Society, of course, all say, no, you can't do that. So where does that leave people then who feel that they have a need and there's no other answer to it, like your wife found, there's no other answer to it. So where does that leave us? That's the big question which society faces, especially the medical profession faces. How do they handle that? So I'm going to leave it there for right now.
One more presenter here, and I'll ask her to introduce herself about the hospice.
My name is Luann Haugen. I am a nurse that has for the last 7 years been doing private duty nursing with hospice patients. And I feel a little overwhelmed by this assignment. I am no stretch of the term a public speaker or anyone who's used to speaking in front of a group, so forgive me if I sometimes stumble, but I can't help but wish that every person in the situation of your wife and many others knew that there is another option and that is hospice care. Now I'm not sure how many of you people here are familiar with what hospice care offers. Do we need to do some explanation?
Sure. A little bit.
The agency that I work for, called Hospice of the Red River Valley, is located in Fargo, North Dakota, and provides hospice care in there and in a number of satellite branches spread throughout the Red River Valley area of North Dakota and Minnesota. Some hospice units are located in hospitals. Ours is not. A person can be admitted to hospice care if their physician determines that they have a terminal illness and, in his best judgment, probably won't live for more than 6 months. Now, if he turns out to be wrong, that's no problem. A person can stay on hospice care. Hospice provides a variety of services. If a person is referred kind of early on in their illness, while they're still up and around, able to be at home fairly comfortably, not having major problems, death is not imminent. When they're admitted, a staff nurse will make periodic visits, usually twice a week, to determine what their needs are. Social workers get involved, helping the family deal with many different issues, including insurance, and I'm not completely familiar with all of the areas that they cover. Volunteers can be involved. Maybe the caregiver in the home needs to be able to get out once in a while and they can't leave this person alone, and so volunteers can come in either to provide that or to provide some diversion for the patient if they are in a physical condition where they can benefit from that. Many different spiritual care, they're very strongly encouraged if they have a church connection. Their pastor is always contacted and they are encouraged to make use of his counsel. If not, there is a clergyman on staff that will provide spiritual care if he is welcomed. Then the main object of the nurse's visits at this point is to help with symptom control, which can cover a whole gamut of things, but of course the primary one gets to be pain control. And at least as far as the staff nurses in our organization, and I would expect in all others, they are experts at pain control and of being the go-between between the physician and the patient. This patient can be in their own home if that's a private home. If their home is a nursing home, they may still have hospice care and provide things that the nursing home is not able to provide. A home health aide can come in if the person needs assistance bathing and it's more than the family can handle. There are many, many different things that can be provided. As a private duty nurse, I usually only get involved at the very end of life, when that person's care is more than the family can manage. It, in some cases, might be a nurse that comes in only for the night shift so that the caregiver can rest and the family can manage otherwise. But then usually when things, when they say imminent death, imminent death is a reason for providing round-the-clock nursing care. Granted, hospice does not offer hope as far as cure, but they offer whatever can be done to keep that patient comfortable in his own familiar surroundings. The family can be there as they wish. He can be surrounded by favorite belongings, by treasured belongings, by, of course, his most loved family. A hospice nurse, at least the way our organization is set up, has great flexibility in adjusting medications according to need. There are specific guidelines, and if the nurse determines that these guidelines for this patient are not adequate, she contacts the physician who can change those guidelines for her. Now, people often ask, well, if you're in a nursing home, why on earth would you need hospice care? That's a good example right there. If, say, a patient in the nursing home has increased pain all of a sudden, and it's on a weekend or the middle of the night, and the on-call doctor has never seen this person before and doesn't know them, the hospice nurse has the flexibility to change those medications as it is needed to keep that person comfortable. I'm not sure what more I might want to say at this point.
We'll find out what the audience wants to discuss. So, please.
Perhaps I could toss in just a little historical perspective. In the work that I was in, I was more or less charged with knowing what was in the American Medical Association Journal from the early 50s. I was associated with a pharmaceutical company, and it was our responsibility to pretty much read over and have an idea. It was about, I think, 1975 when the first articles came out at the direction, of course, of the editors of the AMA Journal, that they start to include articles now directed at the physician relative to medical ethics, or as they would get medical ethicists. And at that time, the universities started to confer a degree in medical ethicism. And before that, it was over in the area of philosophy or religion or whatever. And as time went on, and I lost track about 1950 when I retired, but for about a 10-year period, 1985 I retired, and from 1975 to 85, there would be increasing numbers of articles by medical ethicists. This is a consequence, obviously, of the increasing technology that put the doctor behind the eight ball as to what is he going to do. And I say the eight ball because early on, and I don't know what the very latest is, and I'm sure someone in here can speak to this, but at the very earliest part, the major concern was on two hooks. One was, as a physician, what is my medical legal responsibility? If I intervene in a way that shortens this person's life, am I legally liable in a court of law? And that became a very heavy hammer on that one aspect. And in the other case, it would be that the physicians had been taught through their Hippocratic Oath that in all things they must do whatever they can to sustain life. And there are many doctors that honored that fully, and this went against their grain. So there was the medical legal aspect. The technology came on scene. And now it's complicated further by the introduction of the Medicare, the insurance aspect. All of these things are involved. But probably the biggest thing, and we've read about it in the press, is there's a finding that within the medical community, there is a hesitancy on the part of many physicians to maximize the pain intervention. And the hospice, now you mentioned the nurses, are becoming much more vocal, much more involved in dealing with this. And it's sort of, would you agree to this, on the pain medications and so on, falling more in the laps of the nursing staff to push this to the nth degree. And combined in all this is the underlying, at least about 10 years ago, the underdiagnosis of depression. And if it's diagnosed and treated, many of these people would not. You're shaking your head, yes. Do you agree? Yeah. We had, some of us that are here, a very dear friend. And probably about 45, 50 that had the earmarks of depression that were basic textbook earmarks of depression. And for some reason was not treated for this. And one morning, one of our gang noticed that the newspapers were piling up on our friend's door, on their front porch. And he had hung himself. And I felt very bitter about the fact that here was a man who could have been saved from suicide. A little different thrust than we're talking about physician-assisted suicide. But from the historical standpoint, it's coming over now where the doctors are looking for the state legislatures to pass laws that will clear their coattails of responsibility. That up now, I think Oregon probably is the leader in the nation in this regard. Am I correct on that?
Yes.
Oregon or Washington? Yeah. Yeah. That has made a giant step forward, and we're seeing physicians approaching this much differently than the other 49 states.
Though the Oregon referendum, I understand, is tied up in the courts now.
So it is.
Not,
yeah.
It has not been implemented.
Yeah, no, no. But
it was passed by the people.
Yeah. Yeah. But that's essentially my...
Washington failed.
There is no law, federal law, which allows PAS. It's up to the states actually to enforce it. And some states are more lax in enforcing, like Michigan, where Dr. Gaborkian does most of his work, because it's more there. Guidelines there are less restrictive, and he can work there, and they seem to not be able to do anything legally against Dr. Gaborkian.
Yeah.
The only place really where PAS is legal is in the country is in Netherlands. Netherlands has been doing this since about 1980, and it's legal there. But because it's legal there, not saying that there aren't problems which they find in administering this program there too.
But that's where they gave maximum protection to the physician.
Yes.
In the Netherlands.
Yes.
So when you talk that it's legal, that is the other side of the coin.
Right.
And that's one of the cruxes of this thing is, other than the theological, et cetera, et cetera.
Other comments Kira Kandrew? Thank you. Yeah.
I have just a couple of comments. One is, as far as the Hippocratic Oath goes, where the physicians swear to do no harm, I know there's some other nurses in the room, and at least 30 years ago when I graduated, I promised to pass my life in purity. Well, I guarantee you that this nurse and a lot of other nurses that I know have not entirely lived up to the Florence Nightingale pledge. Same thing with physicians. It's like so many promises that we all make at graduation, we don't necessarily adhere to those lifelong. And sometimes that is a nice way for physicians to dodge the question and not even have to debate it. The other thing is that I would like not to have the hospice situation confused with the actual suicide situation, because when you're talking about physician-assisted suicide, you're not generally talking with people that are within the last 6 months of life, and that is what hospice is defined as, that is how insurance will pay for it, that is how Medicare will pay for it, and they will not pay for any more than 6 months.
Yes, it will. Yeah,
they do. Yeah. Not under the hospice benefit. Good, I want to know how.
Because there's...
Well, okay, you may have a Medicaid component that will then kick in, and that's nice. Right,
yeah,
right.
Minnesota also
does
not limit it to 6 months.
And in most places, they and the insurance companies, they won't. And what they will do is they will sometimes dig into the nursing home benefit for them. But if you're talking about two different things, if you're talking about literally the last terminal bit, if we're going to talk about the Dr. Gaborkian kind of assisted suicide, those are people that are probably 2, 3, 10 years from actual natural death, and probably longer if there's medical intervention. And I would really like to hear some discussion on how we feel about that. I mean, me at 56, you at whatever age. You know, if you've got some disease that is daily impinging on your ability to live your life the way you want to, physically, emotionally, mentally, what right do you have over your own body? What right do you have to make those decisions? And do we as a society have a right to request that our caregivers treat us as humanely as we do our dogs?
Okay. I'm glad that the distinction was made earlier between assisted suicide and removing life support systems, because I've experienced both of those situations. My wife just passed away with cancer in December, and that was a difficult decision about life support. But earlier in our life, one of our daughters attempted suicide after a very unhappy love life, becoming pregnant, and to her life was too much. Fortunately, she did not succeed and now has a lovely grandchild and a wonderful life. I contend that what we are talking about in physician-assisted suicide is somewhat analogous to what our society sees today in I'm not responsible for my actions, someone else is. The mechanics for suicide have always been there if the person so chooses. But to have someone else help them kind of relieves that person of having to make all of that decision or actions themselves. We are making it easier. And I don't think that's a way to go. I think that there is, as long as there's life, there's hope. And why take that step?
There's a suggestion in here. I don't know whether it's seriously given or not. It says it puts so much of the decision making upon the medical doctor, whether he's going to do this or not. It says, is it fair to put all this decision making on the medical doctor? And it makes a suggestion. I don't know whether it's any good or not. But what he's suggesting is that the doctor write out what the situation is and the request of the patient. And then so give the complete history, and then give that to another person who then, well, for example, a judge could then look at that and say, well, this one probably, go ahead, this one not. But here again, you come back to somebody else, and still somebody having to make a decision as to whether this act is performed or not.
But then you take it away from suicide. Then it becomes somebody doing it to you.
That's
if it's going
right.
to be suicide,
right.
you must do it.
That's right. You're right.
I'd like to ask Verlin. About 10 years ago here, we had a similar forum here in Poland. We had two administrators of very large nursing homes from Chicago. I was working at a nursing home at the time. And after the name of this evening was Who's to Live, Who's to Die, Who's to Decide. And after many moments of discussion, they all agreed that families always get into huge disagreements about prolonging a mother or dad's life when they're near death. And I can't imagine how they would make this decision about bringing in a physician assisted for suicide.
I wish I had known that we were going to talk about this, because I have a file folder like this at home that I would have brought with some of the details about these various referenda that have been before the people in a number of states. We know about Washington, Oregon here. They are really very restrictive. The conditions under which it would be legal for a medical doctor to participate in a suicide are very restricted in both the Washington and Oregon referendum. and do not at all meet the concern of this woman back here who is talking about more chronic illnesses where the person's life expectancy has not been predicted, like hospice people care about. I was very disappointed when the ELCA bishops in Washington all came out publicly against that referendum. I had a little difficulty understanding what I felt was kind of a knee-jerk response to suicide, and I wish they had not done that. But that's where I'm coming from. But on the other hand, I'm not sure that the referenda are the answer. What I think we need to move toward, understand how I'm saying this, move toward, is a situation where ethics committees, such as exist in most hospitals now, at least those that I know about, would help the medical person making the decision about this particular patient. I'm not at all sure that it ought to be left to the law to prescribe the circumstances under which this becomes legal or permissible. It would be more useful, I believe, if it were dealt with on a case-by-case basis, but that the medical person would be protected against liability in that circumstance. And that's crucial. That's really crucial. But that we have those ethics committees, at least in the Minneapolis and St. Paul hospitals, where there is a right to die kind of issue. And the committee's made up of medical people, it's made up of legal people, there will be a psychiatrist or psychologist involved, there will be clergy involved, and the family will be involved. The family will be involved. So we're not talking about a medical doctor in isolation having to take on that enormous responsibility of whether I can help this person. That's what I'd like to see us move toward, something of that nature.
Yes, over here first.
Somebody over there in the red shirt had his hand up before I do.
Okay. Somebody over here in a red shirt?
Okay, I'll go.
Okay, white shirt over here.
I'd like to hear from some pastors. You know, I think the reason that maybe some may be against suicide is maybe that person, as much agony as they're in, still has a purpose to live. I don't know if some pastors have followed. You know, I visit a lady quite often nursing home, and every time I leave, she said, I don't want to die. I don't want to live any longer. She says, I'm ready to go home to the Lord. I'm anxious for that. And for me, it's hard for me to see why she continues to live. But, you know, I didn't know if any pastors had had some experience with somebody that now they wish they could die, they live a little longer, and something good happened because of that. I don't know if that's a good question or not. That's a good question.
Somebody want to respond?
I've worked with nursing homes for 17 years, and we've had cases of suicide. One person, I think I saved up some pills and did it that way. The hospice is a fine movement as far as predictable disease, but there are aspects of certain diseases that are very difficult to predict. And the suggestion that we get a committee, I've served on many of those evaluation committees, and visiting with the person very frequently, I still don't know what is best for that person. It'd be very difficult, whether it's a physician or it's a committee, to prescribe that this person ought to go. I find that very problematic.
I think I saw another hand somewhere about on this issue. Sure.
Verlin, I'd like to ask you and the other pastors or reverends in the group, how would you justify the righteousness of suicide when God commands, thou shalt not kill?
What's the question?
Say it again.
How would you justify the righteousness of suicide when God gives us the command that thou shalt not kill?
Well, I suppose one way to respond is to say that we do kill. We put young men in uniforms to kill. Mm-hmm. We send people to electric chairs. Mm-hmm. We do kill. I think we have learned to deal with the commandments in a contextual fashion rather than an absolutist fashion. And from my standpoint, that's a good thing. I've said many times I'm a contextual ethicist. On virtually every ethical question I can think of, I want to talk about the context within which that decision is being made. That's one reason why I suggest the case-by-case analysis of the situation. And a situation in which a medical doctor would have permission to function in the way the patient wants. Just remember that. We're not doing it to somebody who doesn't want it. Mm-hmm. But on a contextual basis, rather than decide that it's wrong, it's mm-hmm. wrong, always wrong. And the truth is, you know, we've been inclined to think of life and death as mutually exclusive realities. The fact of the matter is, we don't really know how to define life. And what I thought about is, life diminishes for many people. We talk about saving a life. If a person is on a machine and is in a coma, what are we saving? Mm-hmm. What are we saving? Or if a person is paralyzed, as my father-in-law, my ex-father-in-law, was lying in a nursing home, and the nurses had to come and clean up his bowels, and he just absolutely mm-hmm. wanted to die. What are we saving? What's the hypocritical oath talking about? That oath was written back when we thought death and life were two different things. Now we're seeing life issue into death, and it diminishes down to about this. That's what we're saving. Because we have all this phenomenal technology now that allows that heart to beat forever. I mean, literally. You can keep a body going forever.
But you don't have to. You can. Fortunately, in our area, there's more and more emphasis on living wills and the power of attorney for health care, where the person can decide what measures they want taken, and in the event that they are not able to be active in those decision processes at the time, they designate someone who knows their wishes and can follow them through. I certainly don't advocate keeping people alive on machines or feeding tubes or any such thing. And I do think that in the hospice situation, with the dying person surrounded by his family, we're getting back to a little more of viewing death as a part of life. This, you know, the family is all around. This is the end of life. This is the way it goes. It's not somebody stuck off somewhere by himself, surrounded by strangers and machinery.
I guess I would ask the question, does the issue change somewhat when we speak with someone in chronic pain, where death is not imminent, but pain and the continuation of pain, paralysis, whatever, that seems to be another question beyond someone whose death is imminent, their life is not bearable. And
pain, I think, can almost always be dealt with. It doesn't change the fact, you know, there will be other things that are going to go on, increasing paralysis, but a large part of the work of hospice people is physician education, because this has not been a part of the training of physicians. We've been fortunate in our area to have students from the medical school at the University of North Dakota spend some time with our hospice nurses so that they can get acquainted with what's going on. And there are situations where pain cannot be managed. I haven't seen any. But granted, I'm with those with whom death is not imminent than someone with a long-term problem.
Medication can take care of most pain, but it may also put you in a state where you're unconscious. And then
it's possible.
Yes.
That choice is the patient's. If the pain is not bearable in their mind, they will usually choose to accept the grogginess, the whatever that goes with it. We have had patients on immense doses of morphine who are alert and conversing. If the pain is there for the morphine to deal with, sometimes it might take days for the body to adjust. There might be a period where a person may be groggy. But usually, when the body adjusts to that, if the pain is there, the other side effects are not a problem. If the larger doses, as I say, it's up to the patient. If larger doses are required that do cause the body, that's their choice.
I have a comment here.
Hey, I was married 36 years to a beautiful woman who died of breast cancer. And the last 6 months, we did have hospice, and it was wonderful in so many ways, but toward the end, she was taking 35 milligrams of morphine every 2 hours. The quality of life was not there. My daughters were afraid that I was going to put a pillow over her face or do something to her. It works in a lot of, I mean, hospice was wonderful, but there comes a point where there's absolutely no quality. There is no quality. Either you are once or twice OD'd because of the pain, the morphine was not getting it done, and we had to do Narcan or I don't know what it is, some other thing. The physician had to come out and do some stuff. But there toward the end, hospice does not have an absolute on pain control, our quality of life. They help tremendously, but toward the end, there comes a point where there's no quality. There's no quality. That's my experience.
And what are the physician's options in that case?
Well, basically, the physicians really don't want to deal with it, as I perceive it. They don't know what to do. They will do what the hospice nurses tell them to do, but even the physicians, many times, they've always got somebody on duty at hospice. I remember one night calling in, and my wife was hurting, and I didn't know what to do about it, and so basically I called in and they got a hold of the doctor, and the doctor was real concerned about whether he should increase the dosage, and it becomes a real dilemma for the doctor.
But we even here as we talk, we sort of established morphine as the gold standard. And I would like to ask this lady here, she's mentioned that in pain control, there's a lot more complexity to it, I'm sure, than just morphine. Or, yeah, so that this is a question that has come up, but that a physician awareness of how to cope with this is still needs a lot of work. And that many of the nursing groups are already on top of this to a greater degree than the physician. I was sitting here racking my mind, trying to remember the source of what I just want to toss out here. I was dinking around on the internet, and they mentioned, and it could have been the American Hospital Association or somebody, but the comment was, and it was, there were good credentials behind whoever told, whoever put this out. I'm sorry I can't put them out. And it isn't really going to help a whole lot here, but they said nationally the incidence of physician-assisted suicide is on the increase. It's not stable, it's not level, and it's not decreasing. It's on the increase. So these discussions are going to be even more germane to our daily life. But it's tragic when I hear what you say and then what he says, because they're inconsistent. You say pain control is possible. I believe this is true. There are those that are specialists in pain control. And our average busy physician is probably not as up to speed on this as those that are trained in it. And that's where we hear about, well, we went to the max doses on morphine. That didn't do it. There are other interventions, and I would guess that your doctors probably give you authority, or you recommend, or whatever.
Excuse me. Yes, there are, my mind's going to go black now, standing orders, you know, that cover many different situations. And then I think I mentioned before, if the nurse who's involved, say I'm taking care of a patient and this patient's pain is not being relieved, my chain is to go through either that patient's primary nurse if it's during the day, the nurse on call if it's other than office hours, and that a nurse can contact a physician who can okay increasing those standing orders, and usually with a wide enough range to give leeway for the possibility that this might be an increasing thing and may need, you know, fairly regular increases for a time until it's under control.
Does your hospital utilize the hospital pharmacist in these cases that you're aware of? Because I know in some hospitals that is the first place that they go with when they start up the chain. They will go to the hospital pharmacists who have pharmacists that are specialists in pain control and work with the pain control physicians. That's pretty sophisticated right now, but
yeah,
I just wondered if...
I'm not sure about how that part of it works. I know our medications don't come from a hospital pharmacy, but we have access to them anytime, you know, night or day. The nursing
department. See, back here. In the back, yeah.
I just wondering, does God have anything to say about the beginning and the end of our lives? I know it's tough to see someone who's suffering terribly. I know it's tough. And I don't believe in keeping somebody alive mechanically that would die, that we keep them alive mechanically. But it seems to me that God has something to say. And I can't help but wonder, we start with this position, assisted suicide. What's going to happen with all these people in the nursing homes? Laying there in bed, many of them, complete care, maybe 3,000 and more a month. Aren't we going to pretty soon start taking their lives too? They sure don't have any quality of life.
The truth is that we have, our, as a society, as a people, we have intervened in God's original blueprint, if you will, many times. I mean, most of us are at the ages that we are right now because of all the vaccines that, and other technology that has been developed over the years. I would be willing to bet that at least 25% of the people in this room owe their life right now currently to technology that we have developed over the last 50 years. We can, so is it right for us to then intervene to the good, or what you think is good, to what you think might be God's plan? Maybe God didn't want us to have those vaccines, and we did it anyway. I mean, you know, if you're going to play it one way, then you have to play it both ways, and know that God gave us free will.
Well, I think God also gives us the intelligence to do these, to give vaccines and painkillers and all. It gives us a lot of wisdom and intelligence.
That's right. But God has also given us the free will to think about these issues and to make up our own minds.
Okay, please, from the other, next door.
I would like to add to this too. You know, Job was a man who went into great suffering. He wished he could die. If we're going to assist people in suicide who have this death wish, which I think some of us have had at times that in life seem unbearable, maybe it's not physical, maybe it's not illness, maybe it's a tragedy, a mental, emotional, deep emotional thing. Are we going to start assisting everybody who might have that death wish? Job had that death wish. And if if Kevorkian had been there, I think Job might have called for him. But God was over and above this all the time. And the time came when God brought him all of this, and he glorified himself. And we have many wonderful things from Job's suffering. We seem to be so afraid of suffering. Now, I'm not diminishing the terrible pain, but let's also remember this. Death is not the end of suffering if that person isn't ready to meet the Lord through Jesus.
Amen.
Death will not end the suffering. Let's remember this.
Well, there's a thing called natural law ethic that Roman Catholic ethics has been based upon for centuries, and that is that you decide what's good and what's evil on the basis of what's natural and what's unnatural. That's the reason why the Roman Catholic Church has been opposed to birth control, using methods other than the rhythm method to prevent pregnancies, because that's the only method that's, quote, natural. And if we get into natural law stuff here, hey, we're all outside of natural law. None of us are living by nature. We're all living on artificial life support systems of one kind or another. I'm not taking a lot of medication, but I have rheumatoid arthritis, and I take 8 aspirin every day. My doctors told me to do that, and if I didn't do that, I'd pretty soon be really miserable. So where's the ethics? I don't see we can establish the ethics on the basis of natural law at all. I just don't understand that.
But if you're going to have physician-assisted suicide, you have to do it willingly.
Sure.
And so then that means that the laws have to be changed, or laws have to be enacted, which gives a physician that right to do that. And I think here is where you run into all kinds of problems that we probably can't begin to foresee. Medicare will get into that, Medicaid will get into that, hospital care, all of these questions are going to be a part of that as well. So I see a very difficult situation as far as implementing a plan that would give the doctors the right to assist in suicide.
Further comments?
Yes.
This might be too simplistic, but I've heard said to reason all of us by
buy health insurance and are willing to pay so much money, a lot of us are afraid to die. And if what I've been hearing for 66 years in my life, how wonderful heaven is, maybe we need to help people understand better that dying isn't bad, if you know where you're going.
That's right.
Maybe that's too simplistic, but that's where I am. I get in a little trouble once in a while, and I finally got the idea. People could do no more than kill me, and if I'm ready to die, then, and that's pretty simplistic, I realize that. But I think that if what I've been taught all these years in my dear Lutheran church, going to heaven isn't a bad thing. I don't leave my family or anybody, but if I was not able to live a quality of life, I wish that God would take me home tomorrow. And I don't know what's going to be the right way, but I've seen too many people suffer too long in their life that our Christians are ready to go to heaven. I don't know what the plan is, but man, in my family, well, I won't go into that.
Connie, that's precisely why I was so disappointed that all three of our bishops in the state of Washington came out publicly against that referendum. It's as though we're hanging on to this life. Hanging on to this life, which it seems to me is totally inconsistent with what we believe as Christian people. But when can we allow people to be relieved from this life when that indeed is what they feel called to?
Can anybody help me? I know that going way back, I heard if you committed suicide, you couldn't be buried in a regular cemetery. You had to go someplace else. Was that anything from Scripture, or is that just a man-made law?
That was true in the Middle Ages.
And it's true in the Catholic Church.
The Roman Catholic Church canon law was changed in the 1970s at this point from suicide being a sin to suicide being sick. Moved from sin to sick. Now suicides can be buried in a Catholic cemetery, but they could not before. Okay. And in the Middle Ages, suicide bodies were hung up on the tree for the birds to feed on, and suicide families like me were not allowed to go to communion. Suicide was so evil in the sight of the church at that time. But thank God, we've moved away from that understanding.
I see. And if you look in some of these small rural communities that have the church cemetery or this cemetery by the church, you will see the church fence or the cemetery fence, and sometimes there will be a few, two or three graves outside, and this has been because of a suicide.
I had a student at the University of Minnesota who made a study of cemeteries around the Twin Cities, and he discovered that to be the case many times.
Some places have had, they moved the fence. The biggest rascal in my hometown was buried on the outskirts, and now he's right in the middle with all the respectable people. It's an hour. One last one, and then if you want to stay, the lights are on all night. So.
Well, I know you're in favor of the right to die referendum in Washington, for instance. And you also talked about all of the safeguards that there were. And let's go back to your wife's situation. If the right to die referendum had passed with all these safeguards, what do you think would have happened to your wife?
She would not be eligible.
Okay.
Given those safeguards.
Right. Beg your pardon?
She would not be eligible under the Washington referendum. Right. You understand what I'm saying by eligible, you see. She would not be eligible for a physician-assisted suicide under the Washington law, if that had become law.
And what safeguard was there? That
well, I wish I had the details. Maybe some of you who live in Washington can remember that election back.
Well, I know there had to be, three people, there had to be an agreement, a committee of people that would agree.
Yeah.
But I'm confused by what you said, that there should have been some way for somebody to help your wife. But who would? There wouldn't have been anybody to help with it, right?
Well, it goes back to the question or issue somebody raised over here about the difference between somebody who is sick and will die soon and somebody who has a chronic illness and is gradually being more and more debilitated, as was the case with my wife. There are two different situations, and the second situation is not met by any of the referenda that we were talking about. That's the reason why I said earlier, I'm not really sure those referenda are the answer. I think some other way of approaching the case-by-case situation in a hospital setting or whatever would be closer to what I would like to see us move toward as a society than to have carefully prescribed laws such as those referenda before the people.
I have talked to a hospital social worker one time after one of my church members committed suicide, and I was crying like a baby in her office dealing with this myself. And she said, you know, this is the last decision this person has made, and this is the way that he feels that he can do best for himself.
There are those people who believe that they have a right, there's a right to live, and they also have the right to die.